Landing on the wrong Greek island on a youthful holiday never deterred Joanna Lumley from having the time of her life and falling in love with Greece. A few years back, as Greece was plunging into a lengthy economic recession, the British actress and TV presenter traveled with a film crew to create a four-part video series called Joanna Lumley's Greek Odyssey. In it, she sees the sights and meets the people, from the Parthenon to Mount Olympus, from Corfu to the Turkish border, as she wanders well off the usual tourist trails. Joanna Lumley returns with us from the Travel with Rick Steves archives to share her encounters from Athens into the north of Greece. Joanna, welcome back.
Hello, Rick.
Joanna, you have a particular passion for Greece. Where did that come from?
I do. I just love it. Well, the idea that everything we know about came from Greece in the old days, the way that we do medicine, theatre, sport, politics, democracy, all these things came from Greece in the first place. My sister was named after her Greek godmother, Eleni. I couldn't wait to get to Greece, and the first time I went there, I was only 18. Absolutely fell in love with it, with the kindness of the people, with the extraordinary resilient nature of the populace there, which I think is largely because they're a maritime nation and actually were always at war with each other within the islands and within the regions, but are now united under the blue and white flag of Greece.
And that blue and white flag of Greece flies from the Acropolis, and I just love standing on top of the Acropolis and thinking back to the golden age of Greece, and you've got the Parthenon there, and the scant remains, but the powerful and evocative remains of the grandeur of Greece at its cultural pinnacle. And you stand there under that blue and white flag, and you can look out and see almost half of all the people in that country from that perch in Athens with that magnificent city all around you. And then you turn around and you see the Parthenon, the greatest temple of the ancient world. Now, I've been there filming, and I didn't have quite the connections you had, and we had to stand behind the ropes and film it from the ground around it. You got to go inside, and not only inside, but up into it. Tell us about filming in the Parthenon.
It took a long time and a great deal of careful and, you know, diplomatic negotiations, and they kindly let us in. It is absolutely awesome. All the things that I'd learnt about it before, which is that the pillars aren't straight, because to give the impression of straightness, they are curved and that they aren't in a straight line.
So I love that concept architecturally. Architects know that if you have a long straight line, like a baseline, the illusion it'll be sagging even if it's straight. So they bend it up just a bit so that it looks straight.
And Rick, you could even standing outside, you could see the immensity of those columns. And you think, how on earth did they manage to build one, let alone all of those, let alone with the pediments and the roofs and the inner temples of them? And then right up high, they said, and the cameras were rolling, otherwise I promise you I wouldn't have done it. They said, oh, here's your stepladder, Joanna, you're just going up here. And I said, what do you mean? Because I've got a very bad head for heights. They said, you're going to climb up and see the work that they're doing.
I remember it was so exciting to watch you getting drawn up into the scaffolding up high on the Parthenon.
Right,
and then you look back
and
at the camera and you said, this is for the viewers. I wouldn't do this otherwise. I love you,
They were working with dentist's tools, tiny picks, tiny little brushes, just working round a horse's leg or the face of somebody, a little bit of acanthus leaf. They were working away right so high up you could only see it with a spyglass if you were on the ground. And they've made the most wonderful museum, which again is air-conditioned and all the pieces of the Parthenon, which actually you wouldn't be able to see it, even if it was in perfect condition, because it's all miles above your head.
Yeah.
So all the bits that have tumbled down or have been broken down are all now at eye level, and you can examine them.
So this is the new Acropolis Museum you're talking about, in the shadow, literally in the shadow of
in
the Acropolis.
Shadow.
And in
absolutely
the old days,
beautiful.
You would go across town to the big National Museum of Archaeology, but today, you want to, if you have limited time, it's right there. It's a state-of-the-art museum right there in the Acropolis, long-awaited, and that's where you find the stone and carved treasures of the Acropolis taken out of that acidic air of that big city of millions and millions of people and safely on display for all of us travelers. You know, Joanna, later that night you were at a party and you were talking about how they don't throw the plates anymore.
I don't know where the plate smashing thing came, but it's one of those old sort of canards which appears every time you mention Greece. They go smash, smash the plates.
Mm-hmm.
They said rather dismissively, we haven't smashed plates for years.
But they
urban
do throw
myth.
Flowers.
But anyway, they do throw flowers. They love to party. And when we visited, they were just at the beginning of their real, real financial crisis. But unbowed, blooded but unbowed, they went on dancing, they went on buying flowers, carnations and things like that, which they would throw onto the stage, shouting applause for whichever pop singer or, you know, ballad singer was singing at the time.
Welcome to Caramella.
My host tonight is nightclub owner Yanis Boitipakos, which means naughty boy.
We live for today, for the this day.
For this moment.
Yes, for the moment. We don't care for tomorrow.
And you party all
tomorrow maybe everything...
Everything boom.
Fun to balance your sightseeing experience with climbing around the Acropolis and then going to a party in the evening where they're throwing flowers.
Honestly, can you imagine? It was quite extraordinary. But Greece does hit you like that. It's the modern and the ancient all rolled up in one, every day and everywhere you go.
Joanna, you're probably the most British person I think I can remember interviewing. And when you go to the Acropolis, of course, the issue is the art treasures of the Acropolis are to a great degree in London. And the Greeks would love to have those Elgin marbles that were taken to England ages ago and are now beautifully displayed in the British Museum. They'd like it back in their what they consider the rightful place in the Acropolis. And London always says, well, you don't have a safe and proper place to put it, so they're better off in London. Now the Greeks have made this state-of-the-art museum, and they've actually got a place sort of poignantly vacant and waiting for the return of those Elgin marbles. As an English traveler and a proud Brit, what's your take on that?
I know, I have to tread terribly carefully around this one because, you know, in my girl guide thing, you go, yeah, give them back tomorrow. But of course, I've done a bit more research about it. One is that it was under the Ottoman Empire that the marbles were sold to Lord Elgin, and he retrieved them because at the time the Parthenon was falling down and everything was being taken away and reused, smashed up. It was not being looked after or loved. And he got these treasures, said, I'd like to buy them, and whoever the Ottoman overseer was said, yeah, you can have them for whatever it was, and they were taken and carefully brought back and are now, as you can imagine, the crown of glory in the British Museum. I have talked on both sides of the fence about this because I know the Greeks are absolutely adamant that they should be given back. The British Museum's take on it is that they will be seen by far more people because so many more people come to the British Museum than actually ever go to Athens. The second thing is that they say if everything that came from a country must go back to the country, what are we going to say to our art galleries? Does every French impressionist painting have to leave the walls of Chicago and come back to France? Mm-hmm. I mean, when does it end? When things have been bought at a cost which is now considered wrong and taken away and treasured and looked after somewhere else. So we're all in a bit of a muddle about this. I'm not quite sure what the thing is. I know that we also have, from Egypt, we have the Rosetta Stone in the British Museum, but I've also seen the Rosetta Stone in Egypt, the fake Rosetta Stone. You could put me up against a wall with a gun to my head and I couldn't tell you which was which.
Right.
So now we can do copies so brilliantly. Maybe that's the way around. Maybe they're copies in the British Museum already.
Maybe you wouldn't know, yeah. But you're sort of making a case that conceivably the precious Elgin marbles might not have survived through these crazy ages had not...
Oh, no, they wouldn't have. They would have been utterly destroyed. And so, they would have been also... The air was so bad that they were all corroding away like mad.
I've been in the sacristy or the treasury of St. Mark's Basilica in Venice, and it's got some of the most precious treasures from Constantinople that were basically looted and plundered from Constantinople back in the old days, centuries ago. And you can make a very good case that they would have never survived to this day had they not been taken into a more stable environment of Venice instead of Constantinople. And for that reason, they survive. And for that reason, they're in Venice and not in Constantinople.
It's really difficult. It's a really difficult problem because other times, other customs, I don't know. It's always worth thinking about, though. And I talked and talked and talked. And of course, everybody in Greece said, bring them back. And there's a beautiful statue, which I'm sure you've seen, of Melina Mercouri, the most confident and passionate advocate for the return of the Elgin marbles. Mm-hmm. And there she is, her face turned upwards to the Parthenon, shouting and eyes blazing, saying, bring us back our marbles. Anyway, I've put in my plea, but the chances are they're not going to go back, I think.
Joanna Lumley's with us on Travel with Rick Steves to recall what a delight it was to film her four-part TV series, Joanna Lumley's Greek Odyssey. You might find it on a public TV schedule from time to time, on DVD, or from a variety of streaming services. Joanna, one thing I enjoyed about your series on Greece was this trip across the north of Greece. You went from Corfu, which is the island people sail to from Italy on the way to Greece, and then instead of heading on down to Athens like everybody does, you went north along the border, just south of Albania and Macedonia and all the way over to the border, the troubled border of Greece and Turkey. In that trip, first of all, Corfu, part of it has a nickname Kensington on the Sea. What's that all about?
I know. Because it's got such an English influence. It was mostly Italian, actually, the Italian architecture and so on. So it looks like a very Italian island. But the English, for some reason, it adopted Englishness, and it loved cricket.
And you popped in on an aristocratic guy who has a mansion right on the beach there.
Count Flamboriari, wow. Who's just extraordinary, the most charming and delightful man. And the whole of Corfu is bewitching. It's quite unlike the rest of Greece, I should say. It's got a very Mediterranean feeling to it, as opposed to Aegean.
It feels a little more Italian or something to me.
Yes.
Now, you went further north, and this is where I've never talked to anybody who's traveled here, and it was right on the border of Albania, and it was all mountains and pure, pure nature. This was Lord Byron traveled there and was inspired by it.
Oh, it's just extraordinary. He rode up there to go into Albania with his friend Harold Hobhouse. But I just was there just for a little bit, riding up to one of the monasteries where he spent a night when there was a storm. And just at the time we were filming it, a great storm rolled in, we think sent exactly by Byron.
That was great. And you had the cameras rolling in that remote
cameras
place.
Rolling, oh. The horses off camera. The horses were rearing. We were rushing for cover. And it was an absolute cloudburst, which is exactly what he'd written about in his diaries.
Perfect.
So it was pretty thrilling.
This is thrilling. Even the wine explodes. Fantastic. This is brewed here on the premises. It's red champagne. No wonder Byron's dead. I just say the name Byron and it goes mad.
And meeting the monks who stewed their own wine, and oh my goodness.
It was so remote and such an example of how when you go that extra mile, you'll find those serendipitous moments that make travel really, really vivid. Mm. Later on, you managed to enjoy some oil wrestling. Now, I've seen oil wrestling in Turkey, but this was in Greece. How is it that there's Turkish oil wrestling in Greece, and what a beautiful thing to film?
What a beautiful thing to film. I think because the borders have always been porous. In places where you're very close to somewhere, you get customs over the border, as it were. You can't divide people by a line or by a passport area. People follow different things. They follow customs, they follow languages, they follow geography. They aren't to be divided by a line in the sand. So I hate it. I hate walls.
There's a little bit of Muslim Turkey in Greece. There's a little bit of Greek Orthodox Christian in Turkey.
We must celebrate that. And the oil wrestling was entirely Turkish and has been adopted and kept in Greece, where they simply adore it. The oiliest men you have ever seen.
But these are good-looking men, and you're just slathered with oil. It's quite sexy to watch.
With olive oil. And slippery as all. And, of course, then they fall on the grass, and the grass is covered then with oil. It's like a skating rink. So good-humoured, honestly. If you were a maiden aunt, you would avert your eyes slightly. But it was done with such good humour and such passionate determination during the fights and such good kindness and sportsmanship quality at the end of it. I loved it.
And then, very naturally, from there, you went to biblical sites, and you're in Philippi, where the first European baptism was. Talk about that.
That was extraordinary. To look at the stream where St. Paul, travelling up, recently converted himself, coming up from Tarsus, travelling up through into Europe, which must have been an unknown place to him, and of course it wasn't Europe then, but the European regions, and he baptised a woman, she was the very first convert. Why can't I remember her name?
Was it Lydia?
Was it Lydia?
Yeah.
It was Lydia. Mm-hmm. He baptised Lydia in the stream. And to stand at the stream where Paul baptised Lydia, which has now got a dear little church there, where they were having a baptism that very day.
So Paul was the first great missionary, great traveller, and he was, imagine the courage and the passion and the thrill of him going to a place like Philippi and then talking Lydia into getting baptized and establishing the church right there in the north of Greece.
And establishing the church.
In the first century.
All I knew about Philippi was Shakespeare's thing. Yeah. I'll see thee at Philippi from Julius Caesar. So it was thrilling in every way.
Joanna, when you think about the Orthodox Church, a lot of people who would go to church in farther to the west, they've got more modern rituals and so on. And you go to the Greek Orthodox Church and it just almost seems intentionally old-fashioned and ancient. But it's sort of a passion for that continuing the tradition in the honest, original way. And I think
when you go
to an Orthodox church, you got to respect the fact that they don't celebrate being modern. They celebrate being true to the ancient rituals. And you find that today all over the Orthodox world.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because in the more modern Christian world, it seems that they've changed the language, they've changed the shape of the services, they've changed so much about it that sometimes you'd think, is this, have I come to the right place?
Yeah.
But not so in the great orthodoxies of Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox.
You could pop into an Orthodox church any time in the last 1,500 years and it's probably just about the same.
Unchanged.
Candles and icons.
Isn't it interesting?
Well, from there, you then got into this crossroads area between East and West, and you dealt in your show just beautifully with that very harsh population swap, almost ethnic cleansing, where Muslim Greeks were sent over to Turkey and Christian Turks were sent over to Greece.
It was done by people sitting at a desk with paper and pencil in front of them and saying, well, look, if all these people here originally who live around the Black Sea, if they're originally Greeks and are Christians, why don't we get them all back to Greece? This was when the Ottoman Empire had come to an end in the 1920s, I think it was, early 1920s. And as ever, the people who were concerned were not the ones sitting and making the lines. I think it was the Americans, the French and the English drawing all these lines up, the British rather. And they decided that to send anybody of Turkish descent back into Turkey, they had nothing to do with Turkey. They spoke Greek. They happened to be Turkish and maybe of the Muslim faith, but they weren't Turks. They were Greeks.
Yeah.
And then the other way around.
And some of them chose to stay. You went up to Xanthi, this little enclave of Muslims in the middle of Greek Orthodox Christian Greece.
Wasn't that extraordinary? And suddenly, having come from all the religiousness of St. Paul's bringing Christianity up, suddenly to find a little mosque and children studying the Quran in an entirely Muslim village.
And they were remote. They were very camera shy, weren't they?
They were shy. They were very charming. The younger ones were charming. And actually, I think it's really the cameras people often shy away from, because when the cameras weren't turning, everybody was terribly kind. Tobacco was their main crop, and they got a tiny amount of money for it. And they picked the tobacco, backbreaking work, most of it planted by women.
You actually went out there and planted some tobacco yourself. That was beautiful.
I did. I wonder how it went.
Yeah, it was hard work, it looked
like. I know.
Yeah, and the women had to do all the bending over.
They did all the bending, and then the chaps come along and water it with watering cans, so it was made a bit easier for them.
Wow. We're capping this hour about Greece on today's Travel with Rick Steves with an interview we enjoyed recording with British actress Joanna Lumley after she filmed her Greek Odyssey TV special. You can look for it now on YouTube and on video streaming services. And Joanna, we've been traveling with you across the north of Greece and traveling the perimeter of the north of Greece. What an evocative and just eye-opening sort of experience. When you think back on your experience on this part of Greece, what saddened you and what made you happy?
What made me happy was to go to Thrace. I don't know why, but it's a word that I'd known all my life and I've always studying atlases and maps. The idea of going to Thrace, which is this extraordinary area. What saddened me, of course, was going through Thrace to Evrost in the extreme eastern part of Thrace where Greece meets the Turkish border. Is, of course, hostility again. Mm-hmm. And so there are gun emplacements and army encampments on each side and a great sense of tension there. And it was difficult to film. And you think, people, I looked around and the countryside was as beautiful and as tranquil with birds singing and trees bearing fruit. And you think, why are we fighting? That's what made me think, why are we fighting? But I live in hope, actually, Rick, and I know you do too. Because if you travel, you always live in hope.
Joanna, thank you for all the work you put into producing Joanna Lumley's Greek Odyssey, and I want to talk to you after your next adventure. Thanks a lot, and best wishes.
Thank you so much, Rick. Goodbye.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Kasmira Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Special thanks to the BBC in London for studio help this week. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.